Phoenix is a relatively young city, but it still had its share of development plans over the years. Now there's more. What's the plan to reinvent three Phoenix neighborhoods?
These are the ways how great cities have been built. One building at a time, one adaptive reuse at a time, one block at a time, one street at a time.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, proposals for transit-oriented development, also an update on the racial profiling suit against the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, and why some valley neighborhoods are more dangerous than others.
Plus, access to child care is once again an issue.
What you're looking at here is helping people who are really wanting to work, wanting to take care of their families, and who need some help to bridge that gap.
Plus, cowboys, a cemetery, and art imitating literature, and vice versa.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. A couple of accidents to watch out for. 101 southbound in the East Valley at Southern and the 101 southbound in the West Valley at Thomas. Valley weather for this weekend, it'll cool off a bit. We're looking for partly cloudy skies and high temperatures closer to 90 than to 100. Unfortunately, right now, we're much closer to 100. It's 97 degrees, Mark.
Governor Jan Brewer has signed the new state budget into law, the notification from her office coming just a few moments ago. Her office calls it a balanced, principled, and fiscally prudent spending plan. The $9.2 billion budget spends less than what the governor had originally proposed in January, but more than what the Senate's plan had originally called for. Even though she signed the plan, the governor did line item veto some provisions, including some money for career and technical education and a landing strip in northern Arizona. The new fiscal year starts on July 1st.
The governor also signed a bill today that eliminates sales taxes on the electricity and natural gas manufacturers and mining smelters buy, calling it another smart tax reform that'll bolster job creation in Arizona. The tax cut is expected to cost the state general fund at least $17 million a year. The governor called for the elimination of the tax in her State of the State address in January, saying it was needed to make Arizona more competitive and draw new manufacturing to the state. The bill received bipartisan support in both the State House and Senate.
The Navajo Nation's legislative branch has voted to formally oppose the use of the name Washington Redskins. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, the measure passed the tribe's council on a 9-2 vote Thursday and was largely symbolic in nature.
The move comes amid an ongoing national debate over the use of Native American names and imagery in sports team mascots. Joshua LeVar Butler is the Navajo Nation councilman who sponsored the measure. He says the history of the word Redskins is what makes the term and the NFL team mascot so offensive.
Historically, the term comes from a time when bounties were offered for the murder of Native Americans. For example, scalps, skins, body parts, even genitalia of Native Americans, or what they had also called Redskins, were turned in for money by bounty hunters.
The council's opposition extends only to professional sports franchises. High schools and colleges on the Navajo Nation will not be impacted. James Anaya, a human rights expert with the United Nations, has also condemned the use of the term. That's according to a statement released on Friday. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You might remember that last month, the federal judge who presides over the racial profiling case against Sheriff Joe Arpaio was pretty angry.
Judge Murray Snow found out the sheriff and his chief deputy had mischaracterized his order to rank-and-file officers. Now, attorneys from both sides have come up with a statement the sheriff will sign that corrects those errors.
Joining us now to talk about the case is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Jude, back in the fall, the sheriff and chief deputy Jerry Sheridan were caught on tape mischaracterizing the order. What exactly were the errors that needed to be corrected?
So, you know, the judge's findings were really serious, that MCSO had targeted Latinos and for traffic stops and held them longer. You know, but Sheridan said in that training that only a couple of deputies had improperly used race and ethnicity as a factor for making law enforcement decisions. But in fact, the judge found that was a systemic problem in the agency. Sheridan also said the judge had found that deputies had held Latino drivers only 14 seconds longer than other drivers. And that was never a conclusion that the judge had made. He must have been confused because there was an expert witness who found that MCSO held Latinos 14% longer than other drivers.
And this also clarifies something about how deputies should be recording the race of the drivers they stop?
Right. So the judge's order requires that data after deputies make a traffic stop. But when Sheridan was caught on tape training the deputies, he seemed to be suggesting that deputies could get around the requirement by putting down unknown on the sheet. So this letter clarifies that deputies need to put down their best guess on driver's race and ethnicity.
Jude, was there anything surprising in the statement?
Well, since the judge first ruled, Arpaio's been saying publicly that he disagrees, that he's going to appeal this order. What this statement makes clear is that the appeal is actually only a partial appeal. They're not contesting that they violated the constitutional rights of Latinos during the saturation patrols. They're only appealing as it relates to regular traffic patrols. So that was made clear in this statement.
So, Jude, what happens next?
Well, we get to wait and see what the Ninth Circuit says about that appeal. And meanwhile, the judge is pushing MCSO to move forward on a training schedule for bias-free policing. And they've already made a lot of the other changes so far.
Jude Jaffe Block, thank you.
Thank you.
Moving to the suburbs has often been looked at as a choice that was made to discover a more bucolic lifestyle, to get away from the noise, the hustle, the bustle, and even crime. But following up on its recent list of safest cities in the U.S., which included Gilbert and Scottsdale, the real estate site Movoto released its top 10 most dangerous suburbs. Two of the 10 were Phoenix neighbors, Tempe and Glendale. Travis Sori works for Movoto.
We used the most recent FBI crime report, and that's from 2012. We picked apart violent crimes and property crimes, such as murder, assault, and then property crimes such as burglary, theft, and vehicle theft. And we put them through a little algorithm that we have to figure out which one of these cities is most dangerous. And we did this on a per capita basis.
What sort of feedback have you gotten so far? I looked at the site a little bit, and some people obviously take these things very personally if they see their city on there.
Yeah, if my own city was on there, you know, and I felt safe there, I'd be a little upset. But at the same time, we're just using the FBI's crime report. And the numbers don't lie. We don't have any kind of bias behind this. We just believe in making this information public. This is real data. And if I lived in one of these cities, I would want to see this myself.
The site also had, just a couple of months ago, the safest suburbs. With people compiling the data, I know this is an unemotional task, but is it more fun, more interesting in any way to compile safest versus dangerous or vice versa?
There's a little bit of an interesting twist when you say a dangerous suburb, because the consensus is that suburbs are just about always more safe. You hear about people wanting to move out of the city to go to the suburbs so that they can raise their families and stuff like that.
That's Travis Sori of the real estate website Movoto. Marianne Miller, president and CEO of the Tempe Chamber of Commerce, says the top 10 list doesn't provide enough specific information to be valuable.
You know, they look at things like property crime. There's a wide range of information there for property crime. Are we talking about somebody got their bike stolen? Are we talking about somebody got their window bashed in? And you know, you also look at it took for a single year of 2012. Are any of these statistics, do they trend in that way? Was there an aberration in that particular year?
As a city with a huge university and an active, vibrant nightlife, is Tempe more susceptible, though, to some of the things on this list?
This is a challenge that Tempe has all the time as a net importer of jobs and students. You know, we swell by nearly 100,000 people every day. So you've got, 165,000 residents. In the middle of the day, you've got 250 to 265. You add in the number of special events that we have here. Tempe Town Lake is the second most visited place in Arizona next to the Grand Canyon. So throw in, you know, a couple hundred thousand people over the course of a year there. You put in things like the Rock and Roll Marathon and the Block Party and the ASU games and everybody who just comes in there. So to compare Tempe based on 100,000 population to a city and that may have 100,000 people where basically they all go someplace else and then, you know, 100,000 people are in their beds at night is really an unfair comparison.
Marianne Miller is president and CEO of the Tempe Chamber of Commerce.
Two weeks ago, we told you about Monica Jones, a sex worker rights activist who's fighting prostitution-related charges. Today, her case went to trial in Phoenix Municipal Court. The judge denied a motion to dismiss the case on constitutional grounds, and he found Jones guilty of manifesting an intent to prostitute. Here's Jones after she left the courtroom.
I wouldn't change nothing I did that night. The only thing that needs to be changed is the justice system here.
Jones was arrested as part of a program that targets suspected sex workers and tries to get them services they need. As KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports, critics have called into question projects that pair social work with law enforcement.
Since 1997, the city of Phoenix has offered the option of a diversion program for some people facing prostitution charges. But Project Rose goes a step farther. Since late 2011, it's offered not only diversion, but social services for those arrested. Volunteers connect people with things like safe housing options, mental health care, and detox programs. In a promotional video for Project Rose, a woman named Tammy said she'd been a prostitute for 25 years.
My mom got me started working, and she would give me drugs when I would go to work because I was pretty young, and so you get used to taking the drugs when you work because you don't want to work sober.
Project Rose is a two-day program. It's a partnership among the Phoenix Police Department and Prosecutor's Office, ASU's School of Social Work, and community social service agencies. On the five occasions when Project Rose has been held, more than 100 officers hit the streets arresting suspected sex workers. Phoenix Police Sergeant Steve Martos.
Obviously, it would be in our best interest to try to get as many as possible into the program, so that we won't see these same people time and time again.
And in Arizona, your fourth arrest for prostitution is a felony. So even if we just stop on the third, that's an opportunity to prevent a felony, which really stops a lot of people from getting gainful employment. It makes it really difficult to function in our society.
That's program co-founder Dominique Rosepowitz from the promotional video. An associate professor in ASU's School of Social Work, she says Project Rose helps people leave prostitution behind. But critics, many of whom think sex work should be decriminalized, object to offering people services after arrest. Project Rose's organizers say suspected prostitutes get arrested anyway, all year, and most of the time they don't get access to care they may need.
I can't challenge that. And I have to ask, what are social workers' roles and responsibilities in the face of that?
Stephanie Wahab is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Portland State University.
Social workers have ethical mandates to honor and pay attention to issues of social and economic justice.
And Wahab says Project Rose violates the principle of informed consent, getting the client's permission before offering care. She argues the people detained didn't consent to being the target of police action. Wahab also points out that not everyone brought to Project Rose is eligible, and if they aren't or if they decline to participate, they face criminal charges.
Collaborating with law enforcement to create interventions that land already oppressed, poor people of color, trans folks in jail is unconscionable.
While Wahab and like-minded colleagues have made grounded arguments against Project Rose, not everyone who opposes it has been so reasonable. Critics on the internet have called ASU's Rosepowitz biased, vile, and ethically bankrupt. And opponents have seized on one of her statements in particular as evidence of how she views sex work.
Once you've prostituted, you can never not have prostituted.
This is from an interview with Al Jazeera America last year.
Having that many body parts in your body parts, having that many body fluids near you, and doing things that are freaky and weird really messes up your ideas of what a relationship looks like and intimacy.
Rosepowitz says the quote is entirely out of context, that it wasn't worded well, that she wasn't trying to demean sex workers, and that her comment was specifically about the difficulties people forced into sex work face after they leave the industry. From Rosepowitz's perspective, Project Rose isn't about the debate over legalizing prostitution. It's about helping people in need. In the promo video, a client named Laura says her life in the sex industry is full of fear.
Because I have both heroin and crack addiction. That's why I'm on the street trying to keep that up. And it's just too hard, and I'm ready for a different life.
But while Project Rose might help her find a different life, the program's critics aren't likely to see past the fact that Laura's journey began in handcuffs. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Still to come, an indie filmmaker has come up with a niche in the marketplace. He's making films about contemporary American Indian issues.
It's kind of comical because, you know, he being around natives a lot, you know, just kind of goes with the flow and kind of knows when to pull back and knows how to, not control, but handle the large group.
The non-native filmmaker and his native world ahead, it's the show.
Good afternoon. You are listening to the show, a KJZZ original. News and features from the Valley, the region, with national and even international news to provide a stream of engaging radio. One thing not very engaging right now is traffic around the 60 westbound. A collision at Mill is blocking three lanes. Valley weather for this weekend. Look for partly cloudy skies both Saturday and Sunday with highs in the upper 80s. Quite a change from what we've got right now. With relative humidity at 3%, it's 95 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, hosting an executive MBA event Thursday, April 17th. You can bring a friend, take a tour, and network with future students and alumni. Registration at execopenhouse.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school.
What exactly is going on in high school? And how come Ferris Bueller had it so wired?
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, they think he's a righteous dude.
Well, apparently Ferris was able to decode the complicated food chain that is high school. Not everyone is so good at it.
Okay, you should just know that we don't do this a lot, so this is like a really huge deal.
We want to invite you to have lunch with us every day for the rest of the week.
Oh, it's okay.
Coolness. So we'll see you tomorrow.
Kate in the movie Mean Girls thinks she's got it made being one of the pink plastics, but it doesn't quite work out so well. Were you popular back in high school or not so much? Were you mean to anybody that you would like to apologize to right now? Hurt by someone you would like to call out now? We want to talk about the complicated ways in which teens try to assert their independence, get ahead, and take down rivals. It's the focus of an in-depth survey of 4,200 8th, 9th, and 10th graders. University of California at Davis and Penn State researchers found significant stress levels associated with social competition at all levels of the hierarchy in high school, especially among those towards the top of the pyramid. The results, according to Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate and the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy, says the study goes way beyond our typical and simplistic view of high school bullying.
The classic example of bullying is this very one-way power dynamic where you have a campaign to make a kid miserable, and we think of that kid as being very socially isolated. And what this new study shows is that happens, but what's much more common is conflict among kids who are high status. They're kind of jockeying for a position as popular kids, and they're going after each other. And they are the ones who are reporting the highest levels of depression and anxiety from that experience.
How is that different from the Mean Girls story or the conflict among the jocks that's the narrative of almost every high school movie that you've ever seen?
I think it's very much related that you can see exactly this dynamic happening in Mean Girls, where as the main character starts to try to fit in her high school and get to be friends with high status kids, then those kids may turn on her. And so it's not that these kids are friendless. It's that there's a lot of cruelty that goes on in the social hierarchy in high school, which I think basically everyone who's been to high school will remember in some way, shape or form.
And, it's Lord of the Flies meets, American Graffiti on some level. We can't eradicate the cruelty and the pain that adolescence produces. But is there an amelioration? Is there some sort of guide here to at least giving better signposts to young people who really have to go it alone in this pretty ruthless competition?
Well, some of this is recognizing that kids need to learn to manage conflict, and we have to make some room for that. The tricky part is that we're not very good at predicting which kids will really be devastated by this kind of cruelty. You know, some kids are pretty armored up, and they can tough it out, and then the same experience will just really wreck another kid. But in this study, Robert Ferris, who is the author, makes a very good suggestion to try to address status in the ways in which they're trying to improve their school climates or prevent bullying. And the more routes you have to feeling good about yourself and thriving socially in school, the better. So instead of just having, the jocks and the mean girls, maybe it's just as cool to be a chess champion, or there are just lots of small pinnacles in a school community that kids can feel affirmed by.
You know, educator Leon Botstein of Bard has talked a lot about the question of whether high school is structurally just not put together to deal with all the different kinds of roles that high school students can have, that it's pretty much set up to be only about the mean girls and the jocks and maybe a few, you know, straight A students, and everybody else is sort of lumped into this dumpster, and that makes it really, really hard to intervene.
Yeah, I often feel when I'm talking to teenagers, it's the only time in our lives where we're expected to be complete generalists, and where just being super good at one crazy nerdy thing isn't enough. Later in adulthood, no one ever asks you to be good at math and writing and singing, right? And yet we have that expectation. And then you're right, athletics and other sort of typical American successful high school activities tend to be overvalued. And there is a very cramped feeling in some schools. But I have to say, in my reporting, I have gone to schools where there are just broader conceptions of who counts and of, you know, what it even means to count, and a real emphasis on rewarding the kindness that students do to each other and making that the route to being valued and to being popular.
So we're asking people to kind of think back in their own lives, you know, whether it was just a month ago that they left high school or several years, decades in my case. Is there a list in your life, Emily, of people who you maybe overstepped a line in being possibly cruel that you'd want to apologize to today, or folks that you'd want to say, hey, you made me feel pretty darn miserable? Could you make that list?
I have a really powerful memory in eighth grade of having my friends desert me. That's how it felt to me. And I spent a lot of time at that moment really picking myself apart and feeling like it was my fault, and just feeling tremendously isolated and scared at school. Because if you have no one to be friends with or to hang out with in a community and people are turning their backs on you, that is a really chilling experience. And that has really stuck with me. I think that if you have other support, and I was lucky to have a lot of support from my family, sometimes those experiences of adversity help you grow. And I think it was a humbling experience for me, and that was probably a good thing. But they do stick with us. And I've noticed in writing about this topic that almost everyone has some very deep-seated memory that comes to the surface when they start thinking back on being a teenager.
Anyone you'd want to apologize to? Anyone who you maybe wreaked some revenge for that eighth grade experience unwittingly later on in high school?
You know, I'm sure I should apologize to someone, but I don't think I ever had enough social clout or power to do any real damage in high school. So I think the apologies I would give are more inadvertent. I'm sure that there were moments when I turned my back and rejected someone because I didn't want to be associated with someone I thought just wasn't cool enough, rather than actually like trying to wreak revenge. I think that's what I'm guilty of.
Negotiating the hierarchies in high school, what we learn is that the would-be journalists were pretty low on the food chain, I guess, huh?
Well, at least this one. Maybe it's not true for you.
No, I'm with you. Emily Bazelon, the senior editor at Slate and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
This is Adam Harrington. I'm at the train park with my family, having a great time in Scottsdale, Arizona. This park has a multitude of things to do for your family, with the train rides, the play areas for the kids, the picnic areas, the carousel for the kids. This is about the perfect time to be outside, be on the train for an extended period of time, and do those kind of rides so the kids don't get overheated. It's just something with trains and kids. They just love it.
Adam Harrington with his family at the McCormick Stillman Railroad Park in Phoenix. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Thank you.
Still to come, we visit the famous and not so famous in Mesa Cemetery.
When you come in here, it's like being in another world. It's very peaceful, it's tranquil, it's filled with Italian cypress trees, and it's just really an incredible place.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Couple problem spots on Valley Freeways at this hour. 101 westbound in the North Valley, an accident blocking the shoulder at Hayden. Also an accident 101 southbound in the East Valley blocking the intersection at Rio Salado Parkway. Look for a pretty nice weekend, if you don't mind a little bit of warm temperatures. Partly sunny skies, highs in the upper 80s each day. It's right now sunny and 94 degrees at 229.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing Steak Lovers, with a selection of USDA Prime and Choice steaks and grass-fed New York strips and ribeyes. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
This week, a Scottsdale woman pleaded not guilty to child abuse charges after being arrested for allegedly leaving her 2-year-old son and 6-month-old kids in her trunk. But there's a bit more to this story than that. Shanisha Taylor had said she was at a job interview at the time, and that's led to some questions about the state of access to child care in Arizona. Erin Radin, the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association, says it's pretty dismal. She hears stories all the time about parents not being able to work because they don't have a safe place to leave their kids.
A mother who is working leaves her kids with in unsafe care or at home alone and they wander out of the house. That's neglect. Those kids are ripe for a call to CPS with a neglect report. And then that triggers all of the increased costs that come as a part of that system. You have a situation that's been all over the news here in town lately with a woman who was at a job interview and left her 2 very young children in the car. That was a very stupid thing to do. However, she should never feel like that's her only choice.
When you talk to lawmakers about trying to convince them, hey, a little bit of money in this program could really make a difference, what do you hear from them?
I've been really pleasantly surprised with how many of our lawmakers really understand it. I think as we move forward, I'm really hopeful that when they talk about the child welfare reforms that they're going to put into place, hopefully in a special session in the next few weeks, that there will be funding for this program.
So when people talk about trying to fix CPS and preventing kids and families from having to be involved with CPS in the first place, this is one of those areas that you think could really make a difference in that respect.
It's so obvious to me. When you look at the increases in the CPS caseload and in the actually reports, CPS reports in the last, 3, 4, 5 years, almost all of the increase in reports is all neglect. That just means people don't have a safe place for their kids or don't have the resources to care for their children. I mean, alleviating the burden, financial or what have you, of childcare provides so much more stability across the board and can really reduce those reports.
I'm curious what you make of the argument, and I'm sure you've heard it, that, this would be a great thing to do, but it's just not the role of the state to take care of people's kids. If people made the choice to have kids, it's really on them to figure out what to do with them, where to put them, how to get them in a safe environment when they go about their daily lives.
Well, I wish that was the reality that we lived in. I think all of those personal responsibility arguments resonate with me. But I think that when you have a program that is well-crafted, that is a voucher program, that has co-pays, that you must be working to participate in, that what you're looking at here is helping people who are really wanting to work, wanting to take care of their families, and who need some help to bridge that gap.
I'm curious if you think that the case that you referenced, the Shanisha Taylor case, the woman who had to leave her kids in the car while she was on a job interview, does that raise the awareness of this issue and maybe make any changes, or is it just an isolated case that people have a particular reaction to?
I don't know. I think that there are parents across Arizona every day making similar decisions that either just don't end so tragically or what have you. So it is not isolated, but I do think it's easy to put it aside and forget.
Aaron Radin is the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association. For another perspective, we turn to Karen Parker. She's the executive director of Phoenix Day, which has a child care center in South Phoenix. She says once the state froze child care subsidies, she lost around 30 kids within a few months.
One of the things that we have also seen is that although we have had some new children enrolling, they have not been typical low-income subsidies. It's either been as a result of TANF funding or as a result of a referral from CPS.
And TANF funding is welfare money, basically.
It is.
So when you hear about a case like the woman, Ms. Taylor, who left her kids in the car while she was on a job interview, what goes through your mind?
The kinds of things I thought about, first of all, there's not a lot of drop-in centers. Drop-in centers are not seen as high quality, and so those child care centers that are really pushing towards quality are not going to necessarily allow drop-ins. The second thing that I thought about is the fact that child care is very expensive. And for a person who is looking for employment rather than they have employment, it's very difficult for them to find or afford child care while they're on a job interview.
What have you heard from some of the parents whose kids go to Phoenix Day about their experiences either on job interviews or trying to find care for their kids while they go to their job?
The families that we have that we're serving that talk about their experience in looking have talked about the general lack of high quality centers that are available and having to really go essentially as they're searching for child care, basically interviewing the child care centers and not being pleased with a lot of the centers that are available.
I mean, do you hear stories from people who felt like they were in a similar situation where they really had no idea what they were going to do with their kids maybe when they went on an interview?
We have. As a matter of fact, we've had a few individuals who have contacted us and asked if they might be able to leave their child with us while they interview. And as long as we have space in the classroom, we will allow that for a few interviews. We definitely want to be able to assist families while at the same time certainly don't want to risk any quality issues.
Karen Parker is the executive director of Phoenix Day.
Like most indie filmmakers, Flagstaff's Travis Holt Hamilton makes movies from a different perspective than Hollywood. But unlike almost any filmmaker, that perspective is a Native American one. His movies star Native actors and tell contemporary Native stories. KJZZ's Stina Sieg recently caught up with Hamilton in Phoenix during auditions for his latest feature.
Everyone's so quiet.
We're all nervous.
All nervous.
That's Travis Holt Hamilton.
So thank you for coming.
And, spoiler alert, he's a white guy. Yeah, he stands out in this crowd of mostly Navajos, flipping through scripts in a sparse room attached to a fry bread restaurant. But Hamilton is used to it. He used to be a young Mormon missionary in the Navajo Nation. He was inspired to make a movie about everyday reservation life that did not rely on stereotypes. Turquoise Rose, about an urban Native American woman, was released in 2007.
And people start asking, when's the next one coming out? So we made another one. People are like, when's the next one? And so it's kind of snowballed into, well, people are wanting our film, so let's make another one.
And so he sort of fell into his niche. Now, Hamilton's working on his fifth film, a sci-fi flick. Like all his other movies, it's super low budget, as in under $15,000. And like his other movies, it might be shown on TV in Canada or on movie screens on reservations. Hamilton will probably bring it to tiny communities where he'll get reactions from crowds made up almost entirely of Native Americans.
We've had people stand up in the audience. One lady specifically was crying, thanking us for making a positive contemporary story that helps other people in the world see her culture the way that she sees it. And so you have things like that that you can't put a dollar sign value on.
Get down! Get down! I said get down!
Kent Smith is reading the part of a federal agent. He's one of about two dozen Native Americans auditioning tonight. Smith was in Hamilton's last film, More Than Fry Bread, a cheeky mockumentary about a fictional fry bread competition. So is it weird to be directed in a Native American satire by someone who isn't?
Actually not. It's kind of comical because, you know, he being around natives a lot, you know, just kind of goes with the flow and kind of knows when to pull back and knows, you know, how to not control but handle the large group and basically knows how to have fun. So.
And Hamilton can portray his observations without perpetuating historical stereotypes. That's how Mike Clark, a San Carlos Apache, sees it. Clark's a classically trained singer who's never acted before. He says Hamilton's movies take a true life sliver of what it's really like to be Native American and make it funny. And Clark says Hamilton doesn't focus on all the regalia and dances that some movies do.
I like that he appreciates certain ideas about my heritage, and that's what I like. Yeah, I think we have a connection in that sense.
Even though this is the first time they've met, Ephraim Yazzie is visiting from Chinle, and he owns all of Hamilton's movies on DVD. He says seeing More Than Fry Bread last year was a wake-up call that he could try more than construction work.
It got me into stand-up comedy. You know, I try to get in front of crowds and, you know, get used to all the people staring at me and laughing and making fun of myself. And, you know, it feels good when people, you know, watching you and they're like, oh, yeah, you're real funny. I really like your jokes.
Yazzie now goes by Lizard Chaser, at least on stage. He and the rest of tonight's cinematic hopefuls will find out if they've made Hamilton's cut in the next several weeks. But not before more auditions are held, from Shiprock, New Mexico, to the Yakima Reservation in Washington State. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Last year, the Fox Network show Kitchen Nightmares featured Scottsdale's Amy's Baking Company. It infamously became the only restaurant host Gordon Ramsay gave up on, partly because of how the owners handled servers' tips.
Do you think the girls deserve some tips tonight?
No, they get hourly.
And so do you think if I went and asked every customer when they leave a tip,
yeah,
that it goes straight to the owner and not to the server, do you think they'd be astounded?
Lisa Higuera, employment attorney at Fenimore Craig in Phoenix, says more than 25 wage and hour lawsuits have been filed in Arizona against local restaurant and hospitality employers this year. That's about twice as many as last year at this time. Higuera says the Obama administration has paid increased attention to potential violations, and a proposed budget hike in funding for the U.S. Department of Labor would do even more.
He has requested an increase in the Department of Labor's wage and hour division, adding 300 inspectors to help enforce things like minimum wage, overtime, and other laws. In the restaurant and hospitality industry in particular, what we are noticing are probably the same types of claims. Claims alleging failure to pay minimum wage, failure to pay wages, failure to pay overtime wages, manipulation of time clock by supervisors, and illegal tip pooling.
So what should restaurant owners and managers be paying attention to? What sort of training should they be doing to make sure they're not doing these things?
They're easy fixes with tipped employees who perform dual jobs, where an employee's job involves performing both tipped work and non-tipped work, the sort of general preparation and maintenance work a waiter or a waitress might perform that's not actually serving tables. The real sort of potential trap for employers is where that employee is performing more than 20% of non-tipped work during a shift. When that happens, what occurs is a change in the minimum wage that employee earns. A tipped employee has a minimum wage of $4.35 an hour. A non-tipped employee has a minimum wage of $7.90 here in Arizona an hour.
Lisa Higuera is an employment attorney for Fenimore Craig in Phoenix, and Kitchen Nightmares returns to Amy's Baking Company tonight on Fox.
Reinvent Phoenix has unveiled design plans for three city neighborhoods, Uptown, Midtown, and Solano. The project is the result of a nearly $3 million federal grant and aims to improve walkability, bikeability, and general livability along Phoenix's light rail line. Catherine Coles is a village planner with the city. We met at the Park and Ride lot at 19th Avenue in Montebello in the Solano neighborhood.
This particular district has some land uses along it that will change over time. For example, we're sitting in the park and ride location right now, which will be not used as much once the light rail extension opens to the north. We have plans for how this site could redevelop with more intensity. Likewise, there would be opportunities on the Christown Mall site for more intense development. Also, opportunities for the Baptist Hospital to really be an anchor for the area at the corner of 19th Avenue and Bethany Home Road.
What do you mean by intense development?
Intense development would be more residential, multifamily residential, adding a bit of height, so more than single-story development, more density for residences, and mixed-use development, so with lower floors having offices or retail.
What kind of input have you heard from residents of this neighborhood about some of these plans? Because their neighborhood would presumably change quite a bit.
Well, the street arterials certainly would change. The neighborhoods that are single family off behind the rail corridor would see an investment in terms of people wanting to come live there, but in terms of their properties turning over and changing for intensity, that's not anticipated to occur.
There is so much underutilized land along the light rail that it is really sometimes it's daunting how much potential there is.
Galina Tachieva is an urban planner with the firm DPZ in Miami and is the director of its team for the Reinvent Phoenix project. She says the project isn't about one big solution, but rather multiple projects at multiple scales.
These are the ways how great cities have been built. One building at a time, one adaptive reuse at a time, one block at a time, one street at a time. So this will be our approach to Reinvent Phoenix.
Tachieva says the real wow effect will be not through one great gesture, but the compounded effect of block after block of a great city. Phoenix's Catherine Cole says each neighborhood's plans are tailored. For example, in the Uptown District, basically Indian School between 7th Street and 7th Avenue, up to where the light rail turns at Camelback, planners are considering how to incorporate some of the area's historic neighborhoods. In the Midtown area, 7th Street to 7th Avenue, from McDowell to Indian School, they're trying to rejuvenate parts of Central. And in the Solano area, Cole says residents want to recognize the area's ethnic diversity.
The 19th Avenue and Camelback intersection is an opportunity for that. One of the plans our consultants came up with took a look at repurposing the park and ride at that corner into a community center to serve many of the ethnic groups in the area, and with its centerpiece being a community ethnic garden in the middle.
What are the benefits to the city of more development along public transit? Why is it important to reinvent some of these neighborhoods?
The benefits are certainly, I would say, the top one would be that we have more efficiency in the use of our existing infrastructure. Rather than continuing a program of sprawl, we're able to use the infrastructure that's in place and service more business and people.
Cole says the plans that have been released are not set in stone and that there's always room for change. But planner Galina Tachieva believes there's an urgency to this project.
There is a lot of competition out there. There is a lot of private investment going into public transportation corridors around the country. And we believe that for Reinvent Phoenix to become a real project, we need to act fast.
Tachieva says planners didn't come up with the designs in a vacuum. She believes the demand for development along the light rail line will be there to take the plans from the drawing boards to the neighborhoods. Phoenix's Catherine Coles agrees.
That's absolutely something that we expect to happen. Our ridership has eclipsed all our projections on the light rail. A survey of our permitting fees within the city along the rail corridor eclipses what's happening in the rest of the city. It's clear that people want to be here. People want to live near it. People want the access to the transit to move about the valley. We just see that as a positive, and it will go forward that way.
Cole says the entire project is a vision for 2040, and that the market will, in part, determine the timeline for development. We're posting some of the Reinvent Phoenix development plans at KJZZ.org.
There's an art exhibit in downtown Phoenix that many wander into wondering, where's the art? KJZZ's Annika Klein takes a look.
Q
Curator Julio Morales lets me into the exhibit space at Combined Studios. It's not a traditional art gallery. It's actually a bookstore called Libreria Donceles.
So when you come in, you know, the first thing that hits you is you can smell the books. You can
the
see
second thing
really
you notice is the sheer
yellowish
number of books. Over 12,000 used books, and all of them in Spanish, making this the only Spanish language bookstore in Phoenix. Morales says the focus is on Spanish authors, not just translations of English language books. And yes, just like in a real bookstore, you can pick up the books and flip through them. You can browse the sections, or you can take a quick quiz and have the exhibit manager find your perfect match. I was curious about this, so I filled one out and handed it to Morales.
Okay, I see an adventure novel here.
So we're about to look for my adventure novel.
Right, so let's go into horror mystery first.
There's some more Agatha Christie up here.
Oh yeah, there's Stephen King as well.
Christie and King, not exactly Spanish authors, but Morales says horror is one of the sections where it's harder to find Spanish authors. But then he hands me my book.
Leyendas Mexicanas.
The book is like a Spanish Brothers Grimm, but with traditional Mexican legends. The conversation Morales and I have about the book is the point of the exhibit. Morales engages guests in conversation on topics ranging from immigration to ethnic studies, and the artist hopes to educate the community about Latino culture and to question why more Spanish language books are not readily available in Phoenix. So where did Elguera get all these books? On the inside cover of Leyendas Mexicanas is a name.
Raquel Huerta Nava.
The donor of the book. She lives in Mexico City, where Elguera is from. All the books are donated, and in exchange for a book, guests can make a donation of their own that goes to the Phoenix Public Library Literacy Program. Libreria Donceles is open for browsing Wednesday through Saturday until late June. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. At this hour, Governor Jan Brewer has signed the new state budget into law. She did that just a little more than an hour ago. It's a $9.2 billion spending plan. Even though she signed it, though, the governor did line item veto some provisions.
And if you're heading out into Valley traffic, avoid the 60 westbound at Mill. A collision is blocking the right lane.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, monitoring and managing snowmelt in northern Arizona for over 100 years to ensure enough water reaches the valley during wet winters and dry winters like this year. More at togetherweconserve.com/valleywater.
Tomorrow morning, you can visit some of Mesa's most notable residents. Well, kind of. It's the second Mesa Cemetery tour, and the stops include some people you've probably heard of, some you may have heard something about, and some who most people probably wouldn't know anything about otherwise. Vic Linoff is a board member with the Mesa Historical Museum, which is putting on the tour. He gave me a bit of a preview.
When you come in here, it's like being in another world. It's very peaceful, it's tranquil, it's filled with Italian cypress trees. And it's just really an incredible place. And when you think about it, the population of the cemetery is very large, about equal to the size of the city of Prescott. I think a cemetery is full of life. This is the sum and substance of this city's history.
What do you think a community can learn by taking a tour of its cemetery?
You can learn about the sum and substance, the people that helped build this community. You've got famous people here like Waylon Jennings, and I think we're going to go take a look at his grave. You've got infamous Ernesto Miranda. You've got the not so famous. And then you have anonymous.
Do you have to sort of tread lightly when you're planning a tour? Because, yes, there's a lot of interesting stuff here, but it's also, for a lot of people, a place of sort of a need for great respect and sort of hallowed ground. So I guess, how do you balance those?
You're absolutely right. I mean, it is hallowed ground. But if you talk to people who have relatives that are buried here, I think they're very pleased to know that someone is coming through and recognizing their ancestors.
Let's go to Lukin Rock, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys.
We're standing by one of probably the bigger names graves on this tour. This is Waylon Jennings. And how did he come to be buried in Mesa?
He was buried in Mesa because his wife, Jessie Coulter, lived in the Valley. Beyond that, he has an important connection to Valley history. Although he grew up in Texas and in Oklahoma, he really kind of got his start here in the Valley. What is interesting, people tend to come by on a regular basis and leave mementos, things that might have been of interest to Waylon Jennings. I've been here when there's a bottle of whiskey. There are coins. One time there was a wooden gear shift nodge. This is the number one spot and stop at this cemetery.
From there, we pass a bunch of markers for people born in the 19th century and end up at the grave of someone who played a significant role in legal history.
Ernesto Miranda is probably better known, as you say, for legacy, and that was the Supreme Court Miranda decision.
How much of people coming to a tour like this and to see, even to an extent, Waylon Jennings, especially Ernesto Miranda, how much of it is just sort of a curiosity factor of, well, this is where this person's buried?
Oh, I think there's a lot of curiosity. And people are surprised by, you know, the variety that are here. You've got Dr. Alston, who was the first black physician in Mesa. We have some people from the first black family that settled here. There is a Confederate soldier buried at this cemetery. So, you know, you've got this gamut of what you would have in any community.
Vic Linoff, one of the tour guides on tomorrow's Mesa Cemetery Tour.
Rock on, gold dust woman. Take your silver spoon and dig your grave.
You can get all the details on the event, including some of the stops on the tour. Hint, Waylon Jennings, at kjzz.org.
Pick your path and I'll pray.
It has directed traffic for decades. Today it's a decorative feature in the East Valley that can be seen by air and land from miles away. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
You may have driven past it, the white Phoenix sign with an arrow directing you westward. It sits on Usery Mountain in northeast Mesa. Did you know the giant Phoenix word has decorated Usery Mountain since the 1950s?
A Boy Scout troop under the direction of an eccentric ex-World War II pilot actually built that sign.
Usery Mountain Park Ranger Brennan Bossler takes me in his truck up Usery Pass Road to get a close look at it. He says the park has had information on when it was first created.
And what they did was they took rocks off the side of Usery Mountain over there and then assembled them into the word Phoenix with that arrow in front of the Phoenix pointing toward Phoenix.
Bossler says the Boy Scout group was given a project to create a marker. At the time, this area was an open desert. It was to help direct pilots to the Phoenix Airport, just over 20 miles to the west.
Now, what's really amazing about that sign, not only the history, it took them 5.5 years of their free time to assemble the rocks there, but it's the size of it.
According to Usery Mountain Park volunteers who measured the sign, each letter is about 100 feet high and 12 feet wide. Bossler says from the tip of the arrow to the end of the word, the sign is 1,000 feet across. That's about the size of the Eiffel Tower. For years, the sign has been maintained by other scout troops.
January 1st of 2010, another Boy Scout troop, I understand they used about 430 gallons of paint with portable sprayers to spray that all those rocks down to make the Phoenix sign nice and bright and white.
The story behind the Phoenix marker is told by cartoonist Benjamin Allen, best known as Stooky Allen. He was a nationally syndicated World War II cartoonist. After the war, he wanted to change the negative image juveniles were getting during that time, so he created a pictorial column on teens doing positive things. One of his stories highlighted the Boy Scouts creating the Phoenix marker. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you know things that we should know, let us know. The show at kjzz.org.
Folks agree young Billy had it coming. He killed two men when he busted out of the Lincoln County Jail.
Ranching, farming, and sometimes even riding off into the sunset. It's all part of a hard day's work for cowboys and cowgirls in the Southwest. but there's also a distinct music and arts culture that goes along with this type of work, and it'll be celebrated this weekend at the Tucson Cowboy Music Festival, featuring musicians like Bill Barwick, who you just heard.
For even more of an old-timey feel, the festival is at Old Tucson Studios, the location for many famous westerns like The Lone Ranger and The Lost City of Gold and Rio Bravo starring John Wayne. But Old Tucson's Rob Jensen says these days the park is focusing less on movie making and more on creating new events for the public.
A business like this, you've got to keep kind of reinventing yourself, and we're getting a lot more into culture and history and heritage.
And since cowboy music attracts people from all over, the music you'll hear isn't just made by folks who grew up as ranch hands. Take the Mountain Saddle Band, a guitar and harmonica duo fronted by Stephen Harrington.
One night while I was out riding, graveyard shift midnight till dawn.
Harrington says he wasn't born a cowboy, but he was always drawn to the lifestyle. As an adult, he left Michigan to live and work in Arizona as a pastor, carpenter, musician, and to live the cowboy lifestyle.
It's changed over the years, but it's still a heritage that's rich and uniquely American.
And the members of the Mountain Saddle Band have been celebrating this heritage at the Cowboy Music Festival since it started 4 years ago. Harrington says he loves the atmosphere.
You can walk down the street and you'll hear this music wafting through the corridors of the streets, and when you walk through there, you think you've just walked right back into time.
Besides music, there will be an art show by Tucson artist Diana Medeiros, stage shootouts, and even some poetry readings. You can hear cowboy classics plus original songs all day Saturday and Sunday.
We leave you with Mountain Saddle Band playing the classic Night Rider's Lament.
Tell me, why does he rope for short pay? He ain't getting nowhere and he's losing his share. Boy, he must have gone crazy out there. Ah, but they've never seen the northern lights.
Plenty of things for the whole family to do this weekend. If you want to see Mark Brody in action, as you've never seen him before, you might want to visit the U.S. Airways Center this weekend for Disney on Ice. You should see this guy, the figure eight, while wearing a Little Mermaid costume.
Triple Sow Cow. The Bond and Beyond Concert Symphony Hall, the Phoenix Symphony performing some of the best James Bond themes. Are there not best James Bond themes out there?
They're all fantastic,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Also, the Blue Moon Southwest Festival of Beers on Saturday and Sunday at the Scottsdale Civic Center. More than 200 specialty beers from Arizona craft breweries and live music as well.
If you haven't heard enough country and cowboy music this afternoon, you can head out to Country Thunder this weekend in Florence. It features Jason Aldean, Miranda Lambert, the band Perry, and many, many more.
And the Scottsdale Culinary Festival, six-day events. Halfway through, you can still catch many events, including the Great Arizona Picnic. That's on Saturday and Sunday. Who doesn't want food and music, Mark?
No one. The show is produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our news director is Peter O'Dowd. And our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great weekend. All Things Considered is up next. It's 3 o'clock.